Good morning. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I CRS. The time is 9:10. The date is Wednesday, February 7, 2018. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today consists of myself, Suzanne Steyert, Deputy Secretary of State on behalf of Secretary of State Wayne Williams, Glenn Roper, Assistant Solicitor General, designee of Attorney General Cynthia Kaufman, Jason Gallander, designee of Office of Legislative Legal Services, and seated to my far right is Matt Grove, our staff attorney from the Attorney General's Office. There are two titles for each measure. One is a statement and the other is a statement in the form of a question. Changes adopted by the title board to the first title in the staff draft will be considered adopted for the other title. For anyone who wishes to testify, there's a sign-up sheet on the back table. This hearing is broadcast over the internet from the Secretary of State's website, and public restrooms are located on this floor. When the title board considers a proposed initiative for the first time, the board will follow the following steps. First, the board members may wish to ask questions of the proponents. This is to ensure that the board understands the proposal. Second, the board will determine if it has jurisdiction to set a title. In particular, the board must determine if the measure complies with the single subject rule prescribed in Article 5, Section 1, 5.5 of the Colorado Constitution and Section 1-40-106.5 of Colorado Revised Statutes. That's because the board is prohibited from setting a title for a measure that contains more than one subject. If the measure is a constitutional change, the board will consider under CRS 1-40-106, 3.5, whether the measure only repeals in whole or in part a provision of the state constitution. Finally, if the board determines it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the board will use a staff-prepared draft for discussion purposes. A copy of the staff draft is on the table. Generally, we take all testimony first. The title board will discuss and vote after all testimony is complete, and a decision is reached by two of the three members of the board. Please take note that we are not concerned with the merits of any proposal here. We are only concerned with the setting of titles. Furthermore, we are not concerned with legal or constitutional objections to the measures, except to the extent that such objections relate to the jurisdiction of the board to set a title or to the correctness of the titles and summaries themselves. Anyone who is dissatisfied with the decision of the title board may file a motion for rehearing with the secretary within 7 calendar days. In the interest of brevity, speakers may incorporate remarks made on the record in prior hearings or on similar measures. The first item on the agenda today is 2017-2018 number 95, Congressional Redistricting. And if the proponents could come up and identify themselves for the record so we know you're here.
For the record, Carla Castillo.
And Robert Duray.
Mark Ruskin representing the proponents.
Okay. And we have a motion for rehearing filed by, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Ben Larson appearing on behalf of the objectors, Randolph Pye and Max Gadd.
And Mr. Larson, do you want to walk through anything you want to highlight in your motion for rehearing?
Sure, yes. I'd like to start with the single subject question and the first point that was made in the motion for rehearing, which is that second subject here is that the initiative fundamentally alters how the Colorado Supreme Court fundamentally alters its role and authority in assessing the constitutionality of redistricting maps. So buried on page 7 of the measure are what I would call two different tracks for judicial review of redistricting maps put forward by the commission. And that's at Article 5, Section 44.8. So what I call track one is at Section 8A. And this is where the commission initially approves a map by supermajority. So on this track one, the court reviews the map submitted by the commission by supermajority and assesses whether it's constitutional. If it's not, then the court can return the map to the commission with instructions as to how to achieve constitutional compliance. Then going forward, if the commission adopts changes by supermajority, this process simply repeats itself. It goes back to the court, and the court reviews it for constitutionality and can return it back to the commission with instructions. However, in this track one, if the commission fails to adopt changes by supermajority, then any qualified appellant, which is a defined term, can propose changes, and the Supreme Court, quote, must adopt the proposed changes that are most responsive to the directions it provided to the Citizens Commission, end quote. So there's no mechanism here by which the Supreme Court can order changes to the maps to put them in constitutional compliance. Instead, the court must approve one set of proposed changes without revisions. That brings us to track two, which is actually the more problematic track. Here, this is the track where the commission fails to approve a map by supermajority in the first place. This is the more concerning scenario because of how the measure cleverly sets the commission up to fail in approving maps. The measure requires a supermajority of 8 to approve a redistricting map. Yet there is no incentive in the measure for the commission to reach a supermajority. Instead, number 95 incentivizes the commissioners to not reach supermajority because in that case, they get to submit their own partisan-drawn competing maps. And that's at section 8B. In this track 2 scenario, the Supreme Court is extremely hamstrung because it cannot even go through one round of returning the maps to the commissioners for constitutional compliance. Instead, the court is forced to select the map that is, quote, most constitutional, even if it is blatantly unconstitutional. There is no discretion for the court in this circumstance. So I want to contrast that to the current approach, which is in the event the General Assembly fails to approve a congressional redistricting map under Article 5, Section 44, which has been the norm, then anyone can file suit in district court, and anyone can intervene in that lawsuit to submit a proposed map. The map put in place by the district court can then be appealed to the Supreme Court, where the court reviews whether the map adopted by the district court is constitutional. At all stages, the role of the courts is to ensure that the adopted redistricting maps are lawful, i.e. that they're constitutional. And I'll just point you to Hall v. Moreno, 2012, CO 14, and I'm quoting from paragraph 33. Quote, in order to determine a lawful remedy, the trial court must consider the evidence presented by the parties, hear and make credibility determinations with respect to the expert lay testimony before it, consider all proposed plans, and ultimately adopt a legal redistricting scheme. In turn, the Supreme Court's task is to, quote, review the remedy selected by the trial court to determine whether it is lawful. That's at paragraph 34. Thus, as it currently sits, it is fundamental that neither the trial court nor the Supreme Court approves unconstitutional maps. And that is the opposite of what initiative number 95 proposes. I think the most problematic part about this change is that it is buried in the procedural review processes and is not expressly called out anywhere in the measure. It takes a lawyer to figure it out. And requiring the Supreme Court to approve an unconstitutional partisan-drawn map directly contradicts the measure's stated purpose of increasing accountability in the redistricting process.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I hear sort of two arguments, which, you know, to the extent that you think it's somewhat surreptitious or not called out well enough, does that really create a second subject, or is that an issue for clear title? I mean, is that more of an issue of, you know, something that the board needs to put in the language, which I might be inclined to do so based on your argument, but aren't these changing of procedures? Hasn't the Supreme Court essentially already said that changing the procedure to have it approved is still within a single subject?
I would respectfully disagree. under the Supreme Court's single subject precedent in case law, a surreptitious provision that has a purpose that cannot be aligned with the stated purpose of the measure is a second subject. And so here the stated purpose that proponents on the record is saying that the stated purpose of the measure is to increase accountability in the redistricting process. And when you have a provision that is buried within the procedural mechanisms that basically strips the Supreme Court of its ability to declare a map unconstitutional, that fundamentally contradicts the stated purpose of the measure and alters the judicial branch's authority in declaring whether something is constitutional or not. And I don't think, regardless of whether you want to try to articulate that in the titles, it's a second subject.
Okay.
I want to just take a brief moment to reply to certain things that were stated in the response that was filed last night. I think it's worthy to note that the proponents don't dispute that the plain language requires the Supreme Court to approve unconstitutional maps. Instead, they argue that it should be assumed that the Supreme Court will be presented with constitutional maps. Well, if that were the case, then of course there would be no need to submit maps to the Supreme Court for review. Proponents' argument that this is a non-issue is contradicted by the fact that number 96, the measure addressing state legislative redistricting, of course includes a mechanism for the court to demand revisions and return the map to the commission in order to ensure constitutional compliance. This is a meaningful difference, is my point. And proponents argue that it's safe to assume that the Supreme Court will be presented with constitutional maps because of the processes that go into map drawing. For example, there's nonpartisan staff, public comment, 12 commissioners. However, under the Track 2, Section 8B that I described, all that goes out the window. If there's no supermajority in the first place, then the partisan commissioners just get to submit whatever map they'd like to the Supreme Court. And the court has to choose one. So there's no involvement of staff or interested members of the public in this process, as stated by proponents in the response brief.
Well, who's allowed to submit those maps? I mean, an unaffiliated voter could submit the map.
If an unaffiliated commissioner could submit a map.
Right.
Yes. So you would have a map submitted by the Republicans, by the Democrats, and perhaps by the unaffiliateds, if they have the resources to, as you know, map drawing is fairly complicated. So, and there are sophisticated systems used to draw maps. So, as I stated in the motion for rehearing, I suspect that this will be an instance of the heavyweights battling before the courts as it currently sits. The final argument is that this is an issue of how the measure is to be applied. That was the final argument made in the response brief. But that's not correct, because on its face, the measure requires the Supreme Court to approve a redistricting map, even if it is unconstitutional. There's nothing to debate or to consider as to how the measure will be applied, because that's what it says on its face.
So I know that's your reading of it. I'm not sure that the Supreme Court would read this as requiring them to approve an unconstitutional map. Don't you think that if they were faced with that prospect, that they may take, you know, apply other means or other interpretive doctrines to avoid having to approve something that would be unconstitutional?
Well, unfortunately, this is going into the Constitution. And so I'm not making an argument about constitutionality. The Constitution is declaring what it's going to declare. And I can point you to the provision. And I don't really think there's much room for interpretation.
So when you say unconstitutional, what do you mean? Do you mean violating the federal Constitution or violating other provisions in the state Constitution? And I know we're talking about second subject, so I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but I do want to understand what your argument is.
My argument is that this changes the Supreme Court's current role in assessing the constitutionality of redistricting maps and forces the Supreme Court to adopt maps even if they violate the federal or state constitution.
And I guess I'm just not sure that the court would read it that way. And you know, they have, certainly they have a duty to comply with the Constitution. And I'm just not sure that they would resolve the conflict in the way that you're saying they would.
Well, under the plain language of the measure, the measure gives the court no discretion and says the court must, the Constitution will say that the court must choose from one of the maps submitted by the commissioners. So I, whether the Supreme Court wants to try to figure out a way to wriggle out from underneath the Constitution's plain language, that's a possibility, but I don't think that should, we should rely on that to say that this isn't a second subject.
Any other question?
I don't have any others as to that first argument.
You have anything else?
You want to move on?
On single subject?
On the single subject, I'll just touch briefly on the second two arguments that are made in the motion. First, on using the chief judge, proponents argue in the, this is using the chief judge to select the commissioners. Proponents argue that number 132 and number 133 was limited just to concerns about the Judicial Nominating Commission. I would submit, however, that the court was concerned about altering the apolitical nature of the judiciary. The impacts here, the impacts on the judiciary are greater here because the chief judge is going to be actually selecting half of the commissioners, not just a pool to be chosen. So,
The court has a role now.
Correct, but those provisions were put in place before the 1994 institution of the single subject requirement, so I don't really think that we can rely on that. So I would say that this is an open issue that the Supreme Court might be sensitive to, and I would stand on the briefing there. The third issue is the prohibition of professional lobbyists. In their response, proponents don't dispute that the Supreme Court determined that a measure that was aimed at altering the initiative process contained a second subject because it prohibited lawyers from sitting on the title board. And that's 2003-2004, number 32 and number 33, 76 P3D 460. Proponents try to distinguish this case by arguing that the prohibition here applies only to professional lobbyists, not to volunteer lobbyists. However, the issue in 2003-2004, number 32, was with the exclusion of a group of professionals, not with a group of volunteers. And the court reasoned that, like the prohibition here, the prohibition against lawyers altered a fundamental right to participate in the political process. So, the court concluded that taking away such a substantive political right from an entire profession must be addressed by a separate subject. This prohibition likewise constitutes a second subject, so the measure should be returned to its proponents. And that's all I've got on single subject.
Any questions?
Maybe an observation, but I think with 132 and 133, I think you and Mr. Gruskin were actually arguing the other sides of.
Yes, we've been on both sides of this argument.
Yeah.
I do not dispute that.
That's a way to guarantee that you're right, I guess.
Sure. It's also a way to preserve our arguments.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Gruskin, do you want to address those issues or any new ones you have?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to, in regards to the first topic about the Supreme Court review, keep track of the number of times that Mr. Larson referred to commission, redistricting, or maps. I lost count. The whole point is that the Supreme Court's role changes as to its review of redistricting. And in summarizing his argument, Mr. Larson, in fact, said, and I quote, "This measure, quote, changes the Supreme Court's current role in assessing redistricting maps." Okay, It does. That doesn't make it a second subject. It just means that the existing rule has to be modified in order to make timelines and to make process work. And in any event, it was a choice of the proponents. It is somewhat surprising that Mr. Larson's measures also changed the role of the Supreme Court, but that wasn't a second subject. As to his argument here, what the Supreme Court does, I think, as Mr. Roper pointed out, is ultimately retain all of its authority. The presumption on the part of Mr. Larson is that the commission will come up with unconstitutional maps because the court is required to approve a map. His presumption is vested in the notion that there will be highly partisan only maps, that there will be no maps submitted by any of the four unaffiliated commissioners, and that none of them can be defended on constitutional grounds.
So I'm not sure he's necessarily presuming that. I think part of what he's saying is that this is something that could happen. And I'm not sure that you've disputed that. Would you agree that it's possible that the court could be presented just with the, you know, unconstitutional, or I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but the scenario that he posits, that this could happen and come before the court, and then it would have to select between just the options that it's been given?
I think the notion that it would only select an unconstitutional map, though, as you pointed out, is unreasonable, and I don't think that there's anything in the measure that requires it to the court to abandon the oaths of office that the justices take and the nature of judicial review. I mean, I suppose that the court could say that Marbury versus Madison doesn't apply in the state of Colorado, too, but they're not likely to do that. And so I think this argument, honestly, you all sit through more contrived single subject arguments than any three people on earth, and I know that you don't get paid for it. But this one in particular seems to me to be contrived because it has to do with redistricting. He may not like the way it is phrased. He clearly doesn't, but that doesn't make it a separate subject. The notion that heavyweights will battle this out and that the poor unaffiliated commissioners will not be able to use all of the maps that are submitted, all of the maps that staff draft, and all of the free software that allow them to draw their own maps that are presumably constitutional because they're undertaking the role, is just, it's a departure from where technology is. It's a departure from where redistricting litigation has been. It is particularly fascinating to me that Mr. Larson cites as proof of what the current reapportionment commission does and its obligations of review are the congressional redistricting case, Hall versus Moreno, from the last cycle, which never went in front of the commission. And so, of course, there was review of what a single trial court judge did because there had been no review before. But presumably that the court would not likewise import that case law for this purpose. I don't think there's any question that the court's going to retain its inherent authority. I don't think there's any question that the court's going to have a multiplicity of maps to choose from. And basically, Mr. Larson's argument is he doesn't like the way it was structured. Okay, that's what campaigns are about, but that's not appropriate for this process. I jumped to the other two arguments. Mr. Roper, you're absolutely right on the issue of the Supreme Court Judicial Nominating Commission in 132 and 133. We were on opposite sides. The Supreme Court very specifically relied on its existing case law about neutral commissions being basically having two constitutional amendments as to two constitutional commissions and forcing voters to choose. There's nothing in the motion for rehearing that cites anything about the Court of Appeals being in the Constitution, being created in the Constitution, or otherwise having the role of the chief judge defined in the Constitution, because it's not. Article 6 allows for the creation of intermediate appellate courts. The state legislature has created the Colorado Court of Appeals and the role of the chief judge of the Court of Appeals. It's not constitutional. And therefore, there would be no similar concern as to 132 and 133. And lastly, in regards to the lobbyist issue, this issue went up to the court. We took it up to the court in 2016, and the court basically acknowledged it and then allowed it to languish. Where the court has done that, as in the recall case, In Re Initiative 2013-14, number 73, and then number 76, when the court hasn't addressed a single subject issue and it gets raised in a subsequent measure, the court basically treats it as if it had been decided they didn't need to raise it. Presumption has to be on the part of this board that the court's not laying traps for initiative proponents and letting second subjects languish in their measures so that when the measure is returned to them, they'll have to go through this process again. If the court was concerned about the lobbyist issue in 132 and 133, clearly they would have told the proponents so that the proponents didn't repeat their error. The court's not setting this type of review up as an exercise in wading into quicksand. And you can't presume, I think, that that is the case. In any event, this is a measure much more narrow. Part of the problem with their measure was that it was applied to any registered lobbyist. Therefore, someone associated with, I don't know, the League of Women Voters, who had registered as a volunteer lobbyist, couldn't have sat on the Redistricting Commission. A much broader approach. As to the prohibition on lawyers being ballot title setters, that was so unclear it applied to the entire legal profession, not just the three of you. And it also seems that it has never actually been followed in any other case. It had a severe dissent, and we think that the more narrow approach of initiative number 95 is consistent with what the court has since utilized. In any event, unlike number 32 and number 33, this measure does not prevent professional lobbyists from keeping their role as a lobbyist and therefore having a role in the political process or testifying as a citizen before the commission. And therefore, professional lobbyists can continue to be involved if they so choose in the redistricting process. This doesn't silence them or keep them from doing anything other than drawing the lines of the elected officials whom they may ultimately lobby. So we would ask you to, with dispatch, dismiss the claims that number 95 represents a more than one subject.
Questions? Do we have a question?
Just real quick, the professional lobbyist, you're distinguishing that just on the basis of whether they're paid?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a defined term in the statute, and that is the test that the statute uses.
Thank you.
All right. Any discussion, or do you want to respond at all? I want to give you guys your full opportunity to make your records.
Very briefly, first on the question of the Supreme Court's role, Mr. Gruskin stated that the competing measures, number 67, 68, and 69, also altered the Supreme Court's role. That's just simply wrong. We took the exact same language that currently exists with respect to the court's review and put it into those measures, so nothing changed. We certainly don't require the court to approve unconstitutional maps. Mr. Gruskin stated a couple of times that, well, this has to do with redistricting, so we're all good. That's not the standard. The standard isn't whether it has to do with redistricting. The Supreme Court has already determined otherwise in number 132 and number 133, using the nominating commission had to do with redistricting but constituted a second subject. The question is whether you're doing something, whether there's a second purpose that cannot be aligned or cannot be rectified as against the stated the other purpose of the measure. And here we are requiring the court to approve unconstitutional maps with a redistricting measure that's supposed to increase accountability in the redistricting process. That's the second subject. And again, I would just point out that there is no dispute that that's what the measure would require. Mr. Gruskin could not argue otherwise. And I would just touch briefly on the lobbyist issue and note that we were both on the opposite side of that issue before as well. And number 130, Mr. Gruskin argued that they're not taking away the right of lobbyists to be lobbyists. That's fine. And number 32 and number 33, the measure didn't take away an attorney's right to be an attorney. That wasn't the point. It took away the attorney's right to participate in the political process by sitting on the title board. And here they are taking away lobbyists' right to participate in the political process by sitting on the commission. So again, I think that is a second subject here.
All right.
Any questions for me?
Anything? No. All right. Thank you. All right. Any discussion?
I guess I can start. So we've got three single subject arguments, and I think I'll just give you my thoughts on them, going from the ones I view as sort of least problematic to most problematic for the proponents. Least problematic on the lobbyist issue, I do think that given the purpose of this initiative, the limitation to professional lobbyists, what they do, I do think it's more narrowly tailored and distinguishable from the other cases involving attorneys on the title board, and I don't think that creates a single subject issue. On the second one, well, the first one listed about the court approving unconstitutional maps, that's a lot closer issue to me. I don't agree with the proponents that it's a sort of, I don't know, frivolous would be the right word, but in sort of an illegitimate issue, so to speak. This did strike me on my own before it was argued by opponents today, and we talked about that at the last hearing. I am just barely, I think, persuaded, however, that there is enough, it's speculative enough whether they'll actually be confronted with the effect of ever having to choose between exclusively unconstitutional maps. I'm not sure I'm persuaded that this will inherently, that the motivation to sort of ignore the rest of the process and only do partisan maps and throw it in the hands of the courts, which of course comes with risk for anyone who does that, is so strong that that will happen. So by a close call, I would say that that doesn't create a single subject either, although I do think it's certainly a very debatable point. On the third point with the judges, with the new role of the chief judge in appointing partisan commissioners, I do have an issue with that. I do think that does create a second subject. I don't think that the cases involving the Judicial Nominating Commission were based sort of solely on its separate explicit kind of constitutional role, as in the more general concern of making something that's always been nonpartisan, injecting into a very partisan process like this does. And I do think that the chief judge issue does create a single subject issue. And that's my piece.
As to the lobbyist issue, I agree with Jason. And I think also as to the Supreme Court's authority, in addition to it being, you know, kind of a speculative series of steps that you'd have to get to, I'm also not sure that the court would view its responsibility as approving an unconstitutional map. And maybe the larger question is, I think a lot of that, you know, goes to an analysis of the measure as opposed to whether it creates a single subject. So I would not find a single subject violation there. as to the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, it's close for me, but I do not think I would find a single subject violation there. I think there's some difference from what we approved with some of the other measures, 67, 68, 48, 50, but I think it's a difference maybe in degree, not in kind. And I don't think, although it's close in my mind, I'm not sure exactly how it would play out before the court, but I would not find a single subject violation as to the use of the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals. So I guess on that point, I'd differ from Jason.
So I think it's a little bit reverse, but I think that the smallest issue is the lobbyist issue. I don't think that creates the second subject. The issue with the appointment by the court, I don't think it fundamentally changes the role of the court, which was the problem in the Judicial Nominating Commission. They have a defined role, and this was sort of an additional role. The judges at the courts appoint people to committees all the time, sometimes partisan appointments. So I know that happens with the Ethics Commission and other commissions in the state, so I'm not sure that creates a second subject. I think the more problematic, although I don't think it creates a second subject, is the issue of the submitting the maps again, and whether that is sort of surreptitious or not. I think that it can be called out in the question. I don't think that necessarily having things that maybe one person thinks aren't philosophically aligned creates a second subject, which is sort of the argument that counsel's making, that the stated purpose is one and he believes that this has another purpose. That's kind of a philosophical argument. But I think that since it's a procedure for the adoption, and that has been found to be, you know, adopting new procedures, a single subject for the purpose of this kind of a measure in prior Supreme Court cases, I think that I think we might have a responsibility to call it out in the language, but I don't think it creates a second subject. I do think, though, that the language is clear, and that I agree with the opponent here, that the Supreme Court, by the plain language, must adopt a proposed change that is most responsive to the directions it provided. I mean, as a practical matter, I think what will happen is each member of the commission will, you know, submit their own map, and someone, you know, each side will submit an incredibly partisan map, and then some of the other commissioners will submit something not quite as partisan, or, you know, they'll kind of do their wish list on down. But I think the court in the end is going to have to approve one of those maps. And because it's in the Constitution, I don't think the court gets to say this provision of the Constitution is more important than that provision of the Constitution, so I'm not going to adopt one of these maps. I'm going to adopt my own map. Now, that may be litigation for the federal court, but I don't think that's something that the Supreme Court could do under this plain language. So anyway, that's my reasoning, but I do fundamentally agree it's not create a single subject problem.
So should I do a motion?
Yeah, why don't you do the motion? All right.
I move that we deny the motion for rehearing with respect to the arguments on violating the single subject requirement in Initiative 2017-18, number 95.
I'll second that. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And opposed?
No.
Okay. All right. So let's move to the title. And you want to come back up and...
All right, so for the title on 95, there are a few issues. The first one is the use of the word citizens in the phrase citizens commission. And based on the response briefing, it doesn't appear that proponents object to removal of the word citizen in describing the proposed commission, so I'm not going to add anything to the briefing on that. With respect to competitiveness, I would say that the bottom line is that number 95's competitiveness factor is only a consideration of whether there was a purposeful intent to politically gerrymander district lines. This definition, in my opinion, does not relate to what a voter would understand the word competitive to mean in the traditional sense, which is that races be close. In fact, under initiative number 95, the commission can draw districts that are not competitive at all, so long as the commission can demonstrate that it gave some consideration to whether the lack of competitiveness was the result of purposeful political gerrymandering. Because initiative number 95 actually undermines the existing sort of common law plain meaning consideration of competitiveness, I think the clause about competitiveness should be stricken in its entirety because it is misleading. At a minimum, the word competitiveness should be stricken because the description that follows it accurately describes what the measure actually does, so there's no need for that word. The clause giving the four unaffiliated commissioners the power to reject any map, based on what I argued in the response in the motion, I believe that phrase is misleading. And based on the response, I don't believe that proponents object to the changes that we proposed in the motion. And consequently, the clause should be changed to, quote, allowing a map to be vetoed by the vote of all four commissioners who are not registered with any political party. I believe, as the chair recognized, while if you don't think that there's a second subject with respect to sort of what the measure does as to the Supreme Court's role in approving maps, at least that should be reflected in the title. And that really goes to the last point, that if no supermajority is reached, then only the commissioners get to submit competing maps from which the court must choose one without revision. I think that concept should be reflected in the title because of its significance.
Any questions?
No.
Okay. Mr. Gruskin, do you want to respond to?
My theory on this is let's make the Supreme Court's job easy. We can do that. You can do that by making certain changes to the ballot title that honestly are not necessary, not essential, but not problematic. I'm okay with that. So in terms of addressing Mr. Larson's point by point, we're not tied to the use of citizens commission. It wasn't our idea. We didn't object to it, but we didn't argue for it. Strike the word. Number two, as a competitiveness, it continues to amaze me that the proponents of 67, 68, and 69 advocate for competitiveness without actually saying what it is, whereas when we defined it, that created an issue for them. I think the wording that you used in the title that you passed is fine. But you know what? If you want to use the language to which Mr. Larson did not refer in his oral argument on the bottom of page 4 of his motion for rehearing, let me take a step back. You are very clear in your title that it is a consideration of competitiveness as opposed to any sort of mandate. That literally is the phrase that you use, the consideration of competitiveness. How you could be any more informative, I don't know, except by making the title longer. But I happen to believe that if Mr. Larson's point will go away because the language that he proposes on the bottom of page 4 is adopted by the board, I'm good with that. So if you, in fact, use, instead of consideration of competitiveness, consideration of whether districts are drawn for the purpose of protecting an incumbent or for the purpose of guaranteeing a political party control, fine, do it. That's fine. Then we'll make Mr. Larson happy and will not make me unhappy. As to the four unaffiliated commissioners, I don't think that the language that you used is at all misleading. But on the other hand, if Mr. Larson is dedicated to using a couple of additional words, one phrase, not registered with any political party, and wants to insert the word unanimous, great. I believe in making people happy if it's possible. And lastly, in terms of supermajority and the Supreme Court's review, I'm not sure how you're going to summarize the Supreme Court review process, but we're open to it. I would just note, and to correct Mr. Larson's earlier comment, to say that they imported into their congressional redistricting language the judicial review language that already exists is a misnomer, because Section 44 currently doesn't provide for any judicial review or any particular mechanism of congressional maps. So what is provided for now is just a function of case law. And perhaps Mr. Larson misspoke and intended to talk about reapportionment and that amendment, but there is nothing in Section 44, so he couldn't have imported it. So, of course, anything is going to be a new procedure. And if it's going to be a new procedure, pursuant to the chairperson's comments, inserting that language about the Supreme Court review is fine. Inserting the fact that the maps for review will come from the commissioners is also fine. It's language out of the measure.
So his language at the toward the bottom of page 5, allowing only commissioners to submit, et cetera?
Well, I don't know that you need the word commissioners. You could simply say requiring the Supreme Court to choose a map from those submitted by commissioners in the event that 8 of 12 do not reach consensus.
Well, it's really requiring, not allowing, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
I mean, I don't think you have to use as many words as you could possibly use, but you can certainly summarize that phrase in fewer. And we don't really care. We think it ought to be placed wherever you think it logically flows in the balance of the title.
Okay. You have anything else?
Based on what I'm hearing, I think they're sort of open to the suggested changes. So I'm just happy that Mr. Gerson's so happy to make me happy this morning.
All right. You want to start, or you want to?
I defer to anyone else who'd rather, but I can.
Well, we can strike citizens.
And then maybe on line, the fifth line, take out from competitiveness. Through the word mean and replace that with weather. Oh no, through the end of the line and replace that with weather. We need to fix a knot there too, but.
Did you want to strike the word competitiveness as part of that?
Yeah.
So through mean as such?
And the word that, I guess. And replace it with weather. Then take out the word not, also on line 6. And this is just my attempt to
capture there.
Yeah.
rather, I might suggest rather than the sort of longer language suggested, whether with the foreign affiliated commissioners, just before reject on line 12, just say collectively or unanimously or something like that. Try to use one word to do a whole phrase to indicate that, you know, it's not like each of them has the veto power. It's that all of them do. Or maybe it's the collective power to reject any map.
That's fine. Collective power. And we don't want to call them unaffiliated, right? We want to call them something.
Is there a reason we don't want to call, I mean, I know it was stated, but it's, unaffiliated works pretty well for me.
Well, because I think that we have in the past said not registered, which is different than, I mean, unaffiliated sort of implies they don't have any allegiance to one side or the other, and that's just not necessarily true of an unaffiliated voter. They just aren't registered.
So I went back and checked, and in one of the earlier ones, at least, we said, I think it may have been 69, we said not affiliated to refer to them. So I'd be fine with unaffiliated, but I'm also fine changing it if there's a more accurate description that isn't, doesn't make it too much longer.
What was your suggestion? If you had one.
My suggestion was that we, this issue has been debated ad nauseum. So I thought that the collective decision was to refer to them as not registered.
With a major political party.
Yeah.
With a political.
And I think it's in the brief.
Yeah.
Four commissioners who are not registered with any political party, I think, is what you have on page 5.
Right.
Right. That's right. So that was just for consistency.
Okay. And then the last clause. What did you think of Mr. Gruskin's just wordsmithing of that concept?
I think it was okay. I just like to see it on screen.
Okay. I think it was... requiring the Supreme Court to...
Right. So would this go at the end, maybe, after that? What we have now as a last clause, or what do you...
Where did you have it? You have it...
I think it's the last clause.
Yeah.
Or after, actually, and after the four commissioners, so...
That's where I suggested it.
So after map on line 13 was the suggestion.
Okay.
So our last clause currently talks about judicial review.
Well, I mean, there's a little more to it because there's the whole track one and track two thing. So unless we want to get into describing track one and track two, I think we'd have to still leave the judicial review in. I suppose it just depends on how specific your argument wants to go. I mean, it seems to me that the bigger issue is who's submitting the maps. I'm not entirely sure that the voters are going to understand that, but at least it's, I guess, something that distinguishes the two and you can try to educate on.
Yeah, my only point is whether it would make sense to talk about that where we're talking about judicial review.
I think that's right.
Yeah, so at the very end.
Yeah.
Okay, so the last clause. So would we say if consensus cannot, I don't know.
What I might say, and this might not get to quite all of it, is instead of a semicolon doing a comma and then say, including review of maps submitted by commissioners, by individual commissioners, if the commission cannot, you know, approve a map by, I don't know if you say by supermajority, but something, you know, if the commission does not itself approve a map or something like that.
I think as long as you say including review and approval or something. I mean,
I think that it needs the concept of they have to select one of the submitted ones.
The challenge, which without I think revision. You're about to say, is
right,
is how to incorporate that concept of it's judicial review, but it's you're just picking between a batch of them as opposed to, you know, wordsmith, you know, modifying or anything like that. Or tossing. No.
Go ahead. It was yours.
You have the floor.
The measure has already specified in line 11 what the supermajority is, so it would really be easiest if you just use your existing language, including judicial review and approval of maps submitted by individual commissioners if 8 of 12 commissioners have not approved a redistricting map.
But then again, we don't have there the concept of they have to select.
Well, we have approval. Well, we could say including review and selection of a map or of maps. I mean, they have to pick one.
Why wouldn't you say including approval of one map from maps submitted by commissioners? Does that get to your concern, Mr. Roper, or not?
I think that's
that helps.
Yeah. And I think, Stephen, you can probably take out approve
right
on the line 15 after the word approved.
There we go. Do you have any other comments about the other changes we made?
Right there. Don't object to any of those changes.
The one thing is reinsert.
Mr. Larson, do you have any comments about?
Only as to the last clause, and I would say that the last clause still does not capture two concepts. It doesn't capture the concept that only the commissioners can submit maps in this instance. I don't think it captures that. And it doesn't capture the concept that the maps must be approved without revision. I don't think that my suggestion was that many more words, and I think it's clear as to what the measure actually says and does. So I would submit that we use something similar to what I suggested. And the one there should be a number one based on how we've identified numbers, not the word one.
Where?
Line 14.
Oh.
Basically, what your clause does is say there's a set of maps from which the commission can, from which the court can choose. So the word only, I don't have a problem with it, but I don't really think, I think you've already communicated that by express language. And to the extent that you approve one map, I don't know where the potential for revision lies, but if the board wants to include the fact that it's an unrevised map somehow in the language. I mean, honestly, it doesn't make any difference.
We think it's fine as is.
Yeah, I think it's.
Should we say fail to approve a map at the end there? Or do you like it as have not approved a map?
I'm fine with either.
I think I like it as is. I don't think we need to sort of highlight that they're not doing their job. Same as.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and read it.
Oh, yeah, yes, I'm still not totally sure it incorporates those elements, but I guess I'm okay with not giving more detail about that.
I mean, I think if we were going to put the only in, it wouldn't be only one map. It would be for maps submitted only by individual right. commissioners. And I'm fine with that, but
I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah. So, all right. So the way it reads now, it's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning congressional redistricting and in connection therewith, establishing a commission and transferring the state's legislature's responsibility to divide the state into congressional districts to the commission, establishing factors for the commission to use in drawing districts, including prioritization of shared federal public policy concerns and consideration of whether districts are drawn for the purpose of protecting an incumbent legislator or a political party, specifying the qualifications and methods of appointment for the 12 commissioners, four of whom must be registered with the state's largest political party, four of whom must be registered with the state's second largest political party, and four of whom must not be registered with any political party, allowing any Colorado resident to propose maps or present comments to the commission, requiring at least 8 of 12 commissioners to approve a redistricting map, but giving the 4 commissioners who are not registered with any political party the collective power to reject any map, mandating disclosure within 72 hours of paid lobbying of the commission, and providing for judicial review of redistricting maps, including approval of one map from maps submitted by individual commissioners if 8 of 12 commissioners have not approved a map.
So this may be about as nitpicky as it gets, but on line 7, the apostrophe in the word states is a straight up and down apostrophe instead of the curvy kind.
Yeah, that's an artifact from the way they get transferred over. I'll fix that right now. I usually fix those after I approve, but got it.
Anything else? Want to make a motion then?
Sure. I move that we set the title for proposed initiative, 2718 number 96, as we've amended the title set by the board at the last hearing, and as it now appears on the screen.
I think you may have said 96.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, then 95. Excuse me.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 96. If the proponents could just come forward and let us know you're here for the record.
This is Robert Duray.
This is Carla Castillo.
And Mark Ruskin, serving as counsel to the proponents.
Thank you. Do you want to come up and walk us through your... We'll start with single subject again.
Sure.
And if you want to incorporate anything from the last one.
I will do that. Yeah. I think that on single subject, there are the two subjects here. One is the chief judge selecting half of the commission. All the issues are the same with, here as with 95. So I'll just incorporate my arguments that I made on number 95 into the record. The prohibition on lobbyists is the second argument. The issues are again the same as number 95, so I'll incorporate my arguments for the record here. Clear title. All of the issues are pretty much the same, so I think you can make the same or similar changes to the title for number 96 to address the issues that were present with number 95. So yeah, that's it. That's it.
Okay. Any questions? Mr. Gruskin?
Incorporate as a single subject, incorporate as the single, as the clear title.
Okay. Nothing new. Okay. All right. Well, do you want to make the single subject motion?
Sure.
And then we'll.
I move that as to proposed initiative 2017-18, number 96, that we deny the motion for rehearing with respect to the argument that it violates the single subject requirement.
Second, and just for the record, I'll be incorporating my comments from the prior, and I assume everyone else will too?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. then all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And opposed?
No.
Okay. That takes us to title.
And I think both the proponents and the opponents, the objectors, have incorporated their requirements or their comments from 95. And I think that would start on line 4 with the word competitiveness. Through the word that, we would take out and replace with whether. And then take out the word not, also on line 4. Would the next change be about the 4 unaffiliated commissioners?
Yes.
I think maybe that, Stephen, that you just added needs to go after the word maps at the end, doesn't it?
What needs to?
Offset by a comma.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and read it. This is an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning state legislative redistricting and in connection therewith establishing factors for the commission that redraws state legislative boundaries to use, including prioritization of shared state public policy concerns and consideration of whether districts are drawn for the purpose of protecting an incumbent legislator or a political party, specifying the qualifications and methods of appointment for the 12 commissioners, 4 of whom must be registered with the state's largest political party, 4 of whom must be registered with the state's second largest political party, and 4 of whom must not be registered with any political party, allowing any Colorado resident to propose maps or present comments to the commission, generally requiring at least 8 of 12 commissioners to approve a redistricting map, but giving the 4 commissioners who are not registered with any political party the collective power to reject any map, mandating disclosure within 72 hours of paid lobbying of the commission, and providing for judicial review of redistricting maps, including approval of one map from maps submitted by individual commissioners if 8 of 12 commissioners have not approved a map. Is We capture everything? We think?
I think so.
Okay. All right, you want to make a motion?
Yes. I move that we grant the motion for rehearing only to the extent that we have amended the title and adopt the title as it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right. I'm going to just take a 2-minute break because number 97 looks like it's going to take a while. All right, we are back on the record. The next initiative is proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 97. And Ms. Tierney, if you could just have your proponents come up so that we can state they're here for the record or tell us they're here.
My name's Ann Lee Foster.
And Suzanne Spiegel.
Hi, and Martha Tierney on behalf of the proponents.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Dunn, you want to walk us through your motion for rehearing?
Sure. Good morning. For the record, Jason Dunn on behalf of objector Neil Ray. So as you've seen in the motion, we have essentially three areas of objection. We have single subject arguments. We have objections to the fiscal impact statement and the abstract that was provided with it, as well as concerns about the title as drafted. So
let's start with single subject.
And I'll pause at the end of that, and we'll decide how to proceed from there, if at all. So initiative number 97, as you know, is primarily a measure that will, as the proponents said during the review and comment hearing, provide a statewide minimum distance requirement for new oil and gas production. The measure provides a 2,500-foot setback, but in addition, it has provisions that go well beyond that. First, the measure permits local governments to require larger setbacks from occupied structures and so-called vulnerable areas than the 2,500-foot setback that would exist under state law. Second, the measure allows local governments to designate additional vulnerable areas. And there's no requirement that those actually be vulnerable areas. They can put any definition on that term that a local government likes and designate them as vulnerable areas. According to the measure, in the event that two or more local governments with jurisdiction over the same geographic area establish different, what they call buffer zone distances, the larger buffer zone governs. So this creates two separate subjects in the measure that are extremely important. And I'll preface that by saying, it affects the relationship between the state and local governments that has essentially been in place since statehood, a fundamental premise of how our state operates at the state and local level. First, the measure allows any local government, by that I don't just mean a county or a home rule municipality, but any statutory city or even the smallest town in the state to increase a setback and set its own setback higher than 2,500 feet, and to, as I said, add any areas that it wants to deem a vulnerable area. So it essentially flips the current paradigm in Colorado that has existed since statehood on its head by allowing local governments to dictate to the state how oil and gas will be regulated in their jurisdictions. And it changes that fundamental relationship. It also does that in a second way, which I think is actually a second subject. As you all know, the home rule concept in Colorado is a fundamental premise, again, of how we operate as a government. It gives home rule municipalities and the two home rule counties the ability to, in essence, control their own destiny, and unless matters are preempted by state law, as a matter of statewide concern, allows those home rule municipalities to dictate their own regulatory scheme. This measure, essentially what it does is allows counties to dictate to home rule municipalities how oil and gas will be regulated by setting requirements that, as the measure said, if it sets a higher setback or creates a greater list of vulnerable areas, will apply to a home rule municipality within that county. In essence, what a county could do is say, well, we deem any incorporated municipality as a vulnerable area, and thereby eliminating oil and gas development in those particular home rule municipalities. Now, I think the response to this from a single subject perspective is, well, it all relates to oil and gas development. I would respond to that by saying, you know, the ubiquitous case we all know, that's the same as saying, well, it all relates to water. That it's not just about oil and gas development, it is about the relationship between governments in our state and how we operate. And to my knowledge, there is no instance in which a matter, unless it's of purely local concern, that a local government can dictate to the state or a county can dictate to a homeroom municipality how it will regulate any type of business or regulated entity. I think in general, with the measure, while the proponents say the measure is about limiting drilling in Colorado through a setback requirement, I think what the measure is equally about is about giving local governments the authority to ban fracking. And I think when we talk about the case law around single subject, where we say, well, we have to guard against surreptitious measures being hidden in the coiled up in the folds of a measure, that's essentially what we have here. You can envision voters who will say, well, I might like the idea of a 2,500-foot setback, and I want to vote for that. But they'll have no idea that it will allow the county they live in to dictate to the municipality a greater setback, or that it will allow the town, the little town on the Eastern Plains they live in, to trump what state law might be. And I think voters wouldn't understand those fundamental changes to state governance that are folded up in the measure. So those are our sort of 2/3 single subject arguments. I'll pause there and let you guys, or let Ms. Tierney address that before moving on to the abstract.
Any questions?
Can I ask how you read the measure? I may have asked the proponents this as well, but is a local government's ability to impose a larger setback limited to the boundary of that jurisdiction? Or could you have, for example, the city of Boulder say, we're going to impose a 200-mile setback that's now going to cover the entire state?
I don't think the measure answers that. I would defer to the proponents to interpret their own measure. Okay.
Thanks.
Anything else? All right. Ms. Tierney, maybe you can start with that question.
Sure. I think that while the measure doesn't directly speak to that, the city of Boulder would only have jurisdiction over the city of Boulder. And so the county of Boulder would only have jurisdiction over the county of Boulder. Now, what we've seen in other oil and gas disputes is that counties endeavor to work together so that they don't have oil and gas development on a county line that would encroach on a setback across the county line.
But I'm certainly not trying to suggest anyone would do that. I'm just trying to figure out there's nothing in the measure itself that would prohibit that. Are there other principles of law that would restrict the ability of a local government to impose a setback that goes beyond their boundaries?
Well, I think that I would address it from the flip side, that says that there are plenty of doctrines that would say that a city or a county can't set law in an adjacent county. So
I mean, I think a lot of the law in Title 31 and Home Rule talks about the boundaries of the subdivision, that you have authority in your boundaries of your political subdivision. So.
And here, so the 2,500-foot statewide setback would apply in neighboring counties. It would only be that one county, should it desire to increase the setback, couldn't affect setback in a neighboring county or a neighboring city.
A county could increase a setback that would effectively exclude anything within that county, but not beyond those boundaries.
That's my interpretation. So it's Groundhog Day, because here we are again, and the Supreme Court has looked at the exact issues that Mr. Dunn is raising twice before, once in 2014 and once in 2016, both times affirming that the measure contained a single subject.
I do love that movie, though.
I know. I watched it on Groundhog Day with my kids, who had never seen it. It was quite fun. I was about to start quoting, but I'll refrain.
So much material.
What the objectors or the objectors seems to be saying, and what we have seen in prior years, is that they think this is a bad idea, and the Supreme Court has said over and over and over that
a bad idea is not a reason to reject a or to find a single subject violation in a measure such as this. And in fact, the Supreme Court has been very clear that it's not going to address the merits of a proposed initiative or predict how it may be applied if adopted by the electorate. Whether a proposed initiative is a bad idea is not the test of whether it meets the single subject requirement. That was from the 2014 case, Cordero versus Leahy, in re title, ballot title and submission clause for 2013-2014, number 90, 328 P3rd 155, and that was affirmed again in 2016 in Martini versus Mason, in re title, ballot title and submission clause for 2015-2016, number 78. The preemption issues and the home rule issues also have been squarely addressed by the Supreme Court in both the 2014 and the 2016 cases. The court there said any effect the proposed initiative would have on Colorado's constitutional home rule provisions does not constitute a separate subject. That's 328 P3rd 155 at page 161. Rather, the court held the initiative affects this constitutional provision only in as much as it directly relates to the subject matter of the initiative. So the court made clear we have never held that just because a proposal may have different effects, it necessarily violates a single subject requirement. The effects the measure would have on Colorado law if adopted by voters are irrelevant to our review of whether a proposed initiative contains a single subject.
What was the initiative number in that one, the 2013-14 one?
There were two cases, and both of them have related, looked at related issues. One was 85, which was the setback, and then the other was 90, which was the local control. And both of those looked at some of these issues.
Thank you.
And then in 16, it was 78. Let's see. So those are the, I think I've addressed the first, second, and third issues. Again, Mr. Dunn's argument that it affects long-standing relationship between state and local governments is just not something the court will take up at this point and has never found to violate the single subject argument. Finally, the motion raises that the measure would overturn recent Supreme Court decisions that held because fracking and oil and gas development is a matter of mixed state and local concern. Again, the preemption argument, and again, the Supreme Court has said it's not going to find a violation of the single subject at this point if on the basis of a preemption argument. So I'm happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Any questions? No? Okay. Mr. Dunn, did you want to respond to any of that? Or? No.
Well, you know, I had a read well with those prior cases sitting in my office. Well, that won't come up this morning, so I can leave that in the office. So, well, my recollection is on 78, and I could be wrong, was that on 78, the home rule issue was not specifically addressed on appeal. Certainly, the Supreme Court, my recollection simply is that they did not get into that the home rule issue was not raised. I could be wrong, so I don't have it with me, but that was my recollection as we were working on this.
How about as to Initiative 90? And specifically, I'll read to you from paragraph 18 of the Supreme Court's decision. They say, any effect the proposed initiatives would have on Colorado's constitutional home rule provisions does not constitute a separate subject. The alteration of the existing power and authority of home rule and statutory cities to enact certain regulations pertaining to the central purpose of the initiative does not violate the single subject requirement.
I'd have to read it in context and go back and look in the at the measure itself, so I just can't answer that.
Okay.
Anything else? No? Okay. Thanks. Any discussion on single subject?
I can start. Only argument that had given me some pause was the constitutional home rule argument. But I think in looking at the Supreme Court decision that Ms. Tierney cited, it does seem pretty squarely on point with respect to altering the power and authority of a home rule or statutory city. So I think I'm satisfied that that we have a single subject.
I agree.
All right. Someone want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that we deny a motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18 number 97 to the extent that it argues that the measure does not contain a single subject.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. That takes us to your second argument, Mr. Dunn, which has to do with the abstract.
So thank you. So I know this is a new provision in law, so if you'll bear with me just for a moment, since this is the first sort of title board season that we've talked about the fiscal impact statement and the abstract, to talk for a second just about the purpose of this provision. The measure was adopted, or the statute was adopted in 2015 for the purpose of providing voters simply with more information at the time they make the decision to sign a petition. When they're standing there in the King Soopers parking lot and they're asked to sign a petition and they don't know what the measure's about and they're not sure what they're signing, but they often sign just to get the guy out of their face so they can go get their groceries. The idea was, let's provide some, at least, fiscal information on the signature petition so that it can at least eyeball at a high level what numerically that impact is going to be and quantify that economic information in a short summary. And that's the abstract portion of the fiscal impact statement. So that's the purpose of the measure. It's not meant to be a preliminary estimate as opposed to the Blue Book fiscal impact statement being a more robust estimate. It's not meant to be a light version of what's provided for legislation. It's meant to be at least as the equivalent of those. In fact, the statute says that for the Blue Book process, the Legislative Council can change the estimate only upon receiving new information that would change their original analysis. So I'm sympathetic to Legislative Council's position having a short period of time to conduct an analysis and to get that over to you before the first title board hearing. But the requirement is the requirement. I actually went back this morning and I listened to some of the legislative hearings on the statute back in 2015. There was a very robust discussion on the House floor about adding in the second requirement about providing the economic impacts, what is described in the statute as the benefits to all Coloradans. And it really was described, as opposed to the two other provisions that talk about estimates on the impacts to local and state government, the second provision about more the economic impacts to the state as a whole was really talked about in terms of what it might be to jobs and revenue of the state in general, or impacts on industry. And that was really the purpose of adding that. That was an amendment on the House floor that was added in. And that's where a lot of, I think, our focus is here. So what I would like to do is sort of cede the floor, I think, to Chris Brown, who is with the Common Sense Policy Roundtable and has signed up to testify. He is the one who submitted the economic data to Legislative Council as part of their process. I'll let him describe it, but it's essentially two studies that were done 2 years ago on initiative related to Initiative 78 and the other setback measures. And let him talk a little bit about the when and how he submitted that, what the response was, and then what, from a very high level, because I don't want him to bore you with too much economics, what is in those reports that we believe should have been used in the fiscal impact statement that was done.
All right, if you can just start by telling us your name and where you're...
Sure. Yeah, good morning. My name is Chris Brown. I'm Director of Policy and Research with
the Common Sense Policy Roundtable. We are a 501c3 non-for-profit organization based in Colorado, dedicated to studying the economic implications of policy changes, dedicated to the protection, promotion of the Colorado economy, and providing information, insightful information to decision makers around the, again, outcomes as it pertains to the economic well-being of citizens of Colorado. So I'm not here as a opponent or proponent of this particular measure, but simply here to, I was asked to come in and provide information around a previous study that was done in collaboration with our organization and the CU, University of Colorado Leeds School of Business, a couple years back, related to the economic and fiscal impacts of a 2,500-foot setback rule for the state of Colorado. So, as Mr. Dunn said, we did submit this information to Ledge Council. My understanding is that they were aware of this, along with another study that was done previously, not by Leeds School of Business, but by COGCC, related to the physical, what this would do to the actual physically due to the amount of land that would be restricted as a result of this particular measure, that then the Leeds School of Business and their research department provided sort of economic ramifications and economic estimates as to what this would mean more broadly to the overall economy. So both of those studies, again, were submitted, I believe, are posted on their website. You know, I was here, again, happy to come in and share what the information said and sort of how, given the significance, given the fact that this demonstrated very significant economic ramifications, not just to the organizations that would be directly impacted, but those that, you know, indirectly, to broad industries, companies, individuals outside of those that were directly regulated. And the study, just a couple of highlights, found that, you know, over the first 5 years, an average of 54,000 jobs would be lost over a time period of 2017 to 2031. A little over 103,000 jobs on average would be reduced from a baseline projection. That would reduce GDP growth. Again, these were estimates at the time, and so this is in 2015 dollars, but to the tune of around $7.1 billion on average over the first 5 years, and 14.5 billion in the time frame of 2017 to 2031. That's a reduction in total personal income, not broken out at this point to the average individual or on a per capita basis, but to the tune of $10.9 billion in reduction in personal income over, the time period of 2017 to 2031. Again, this was predicated on the COGC work, which showed a roughly 90.2% reduction in the amount of surface land that would be off limits for oil and gas production as a result of this, and that percentage is higher in the particular counties and regions where most of the oil and gas production currently exists. There's associated sort of discussion around what this would do for severance tax, and to the extent that they mentioned sort of previous estimates given by legislative council related to declines in severance tax as a result of production declines around price fluctuation. But again, to the extent that these could be updated with current price estimates, current production estimates, you could get additional estimates around, again, the economic implications and the fiscal impacts broadly to state government around income and property tax on a dynamic basis, but also directly related to state severance tax as a result of direct loss in production. So, again, we feel that this information is very important for individuals to have, given the broad implications, and something that, again, we as an organization are happy to discuss and provide to the decision maker, which ultimately in this case is the citizenry of Colorado. So I don't have anything else that I'd necessarily like to say here, but I can stand, I guess, take questions if that's appropriate.
So do you have any reason to believe that the numbers in the June 2016 study would be any different today?
I think so, absolutely. I think that I don't know if I can't say in what direction, but I think that absolutely. This is a market and industry that fluctuates quite a bit, and so the production has changed, prices have changed, possibly regulation has changed, and so I think it is worth revisiting these estimates. I think it provides a substantial framework that can be understood for what the implications are, but I would not say that these numbers are what you would expect today if this were now implemented.
Okay.
But it was a couple years ago, and so it could be very similar, again, but you know, in any case, you always want to make sure that you update projections based on the latest information.
Yeah, and on that update, I mean, do you have, when you prepare something like this, and if it just gives a flat number, you know, kind of ranges or sort of a margin of error based on your methodology that you tend to put this in, or is this industry sort of so volatile in terms of the variables and the prices that it's really hard for anything to hold up over time?
Well, I think it's, you know, in anything that we do, again, I was not directly involved in this particular work. Our organization was, but they explicitly provide a range of estimates, accounting for some of that uncertainty. So there is, in fact, a range of estimates that accounts for price fluctuations, alternatives around changes in production, given different assumptions, to the extent technology changes. There's a lot of parameters you can place on this to provide a range, which ultimately I think is very important and is something that, again, we do and I've done throughout my career in this type of economic research, is providing high-low range. And this study does that related to – it provides point estimates on the economic impacts, but it provides a range as far as well depletion and some alternative forecast scenarios given, again, as I said, some of those alternative assumptions on price, technology. But so absolutely, I think it's very important to provide ranges.
Thank you.
This 90.2% number that's included in here?
Correct.
Just to make sure I understand, that means that 90.2% of the land area would be excluded from drilling under a 2,500-foot setback? Am I reading that correctly?
My understanding of that figure, which again was produced by COGCC, indicates the surface, the amount of above-ground surface land, which would be off-limits for drilling as a result of this, yes.
And do you know what it is now without the 2,500?
I do not have an updated figure based upon...
sorry, I mean without the measure.
Oh, no.
What percent?
I'm sorry,
would
I don't
be,
have that number. Okay. No.
All right. Any other questions for?
I don't think so. For okay. Ms. Brown.
Mr. Dunn, why don't you, and then we'll hear from you.
Thank you.
If you have anything you want to wrap up with.
I do.
Okay.
So a couple things on that. Just to sort of put a finer point on the 92% figure, it's 92% of the state, but it's 95% of the land in the five counties where the vast majority of oil and gas production in the state occurs. So this isn't a 10 or 15% reduction in production that would make quantifying that more challenging. I'm not an economist, but when you have a 95% reduction of land that can be drilled on, combined with the fact that existing wells start out at a very high production and taper off very quickly, so those would become, I don't know if useless is the right word, but certainly less useful wells over a short period of time. It's very easy to calculate. We don't have to know the spot price of oil 5 years from now in order to estimate the economic impacts, right? When you eliminate 95% of the land in those counties, you're essentially wiping out the industry. It's very easy to estimate the number of jobs in the industry. Ranges are wholly appropriate. And the underlying data is all there in the report for them to come up with estimates. And they can say, there was actually some of this discussion on the floor at the legislature where they said, you know, legislative council is very talented. I think they rightly said they were, all the people in Ledge Council are smarter than all the people that were standing on the House floor at the time. And they are able to come up with ranges and say, based on projections, we think that we'll have this impact or this range of impact. It doesn't have to be concrete, definitive data. They can provide voters with the range of job losses, the range of GDP impact, the range and loss of personal income, et cetera.
One question. So right now, if I, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's basically about a 500-foot statewide setback in current law regulation.
That's correct.
And of this 90% or whatever the land that's not, how much of it is excluded, do we know, by the current 500-foot setback?
I think that if that's the same as Mr. Roberts' question. I don't know the answer, but I think the numbers are that a 500-foot setback, just to give you perspective, a 500-foot setback is, I believe, 18 acres. A 2,500-foot setback is 450 acres. So it goes from 18 acres to 450 acres. You know, it's essentially a mile-wide circle.
And does this proposal have that delta in it, that sort of here's what it is now? Or is this proposal just saying, is this proposal assuming there is no setback and saying if you do a 2,500-foot setback, this is the land you're going to affect?
You mean the economic report or the measure?
The CU report.
Yeah, so I believe it takes, I mean, the 500-foot setback was in place at the time. So
it's comparing the difference, or no?
Yeah, I think that's one way to say it. I think it's
against the current baseline. It's okay. Against whatever the current policy baseline is.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that what I would suggest at this point, so we have sort of a challenging situation here in that this is new stuff. I think the board itself, you know, doesn't have the technical expertise to know what correct number is for sure. And we have a situation where, on the one hand, the abstract is, you know, doesn't provide any numbers at all. And on the other hand, we have an estimate suggested by objectors that, you know, is a couple of years old in a volatile industry and has a lot of variables that I don't know that we can just sort of take that whole cylinder line either. I do see that council staff is here. I'd be curious if they've taking this into consideration in the interim and have some ideas on
how
we might want to go ahead.
I think that's fine, but let's hear from Ms. Tierney because maybe she'll be fine with the number.
Can I make a couple other quick points? Because I think it's not just about whether or not the information in these studies should be included. There's other problems. For example, the statute requires that legislative council provide an estimate of the impact to local and state revenues. One of those, obviously, is severance taxes. At a 95% elimination of producible land, it's very easy to calculate what the impact on severance tax will be. It'll all but eliminate the state severance tax from oil and gas production. That's a very easy number to calculate. Some of that's dependent on the price of oil, but if you're eliminating it, you can say based on today's price or based on, you know, this price range, you could easily calculate what that loss to the state will be. Same with royalty payments, lease revenue. Those things are all knowable and calculable. So that's one point on sort of the fiscal estimate piece. The other thing I want to point out is on the language of the abstract itself, because that's what shows up on, that's like the title, right? That's the title for this process. The statute says that it can be that the title board can reject the analysis if it's misleading or prejudicial, and it's both in this case. It's misleading because it doesn't provide those estimates. It says simply that there may be less unemployment or revenue may decrease, but it doesn't provide any meaningful data. But the prejudicial piece is, I think, even perhaps more important. And this is somewhat stunning. I think it has a line in there, and we point this out in our motion. It says, increasing the setback distance to the extent less development improves health outcomes for affected residents may increase productivity and reduce medical costs. That, to me, is a stunning analysis. They're actually saying that, A, that a greater setback is better for people's health. That's a very disputed, if not improvable, statement. It's also bias. And it's really inappropriate based on no information that they had in front of them. There was nothing else posted from Ledge Council that they'd received any information. They're required to post it if they receive any information. So, you know, in a nutshell, it's a made-up statement that I think is extremely biased to those looking to sign a ballot initiative. I think as it. So I will, you know, we have suggested language in our thing that we thought we drafted in our best effort to be unbiased in terms of drafting an abstract. And we would ask you to consider that.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Yep. Dunn? So footnote 5 of your motion, this is talks about when things were submitted to Legislative Council. At the end of that, you say the reports have been widely publicized and publicly available for 2 years, as Legislative Council acknowledged at the time of submittal by Mr. Brown. I don't know if you or Mr. Brown. I'm just curious as to what happened there. You know, there's no citation or anything.
I'll let Mr. Brown address that. Okay. That's a good question.
Specifically regarding the...
Specifically regarding their acknowledgement of the availability of these studies.
My understanding, I don't know if it was in the email response that I got directly on the ballot initiative when I submitted it or in a subsequent conversation, and so I haven't necessarily provided that, but basically said, yes, thank you for submitting. We're aware of these studies, and then they posted them. So that's okay. That's the extent of it.
Thank you.
I mean, yeah, and I think that these have been presented, I don't know, to them directly previously, but as I said, our organization and Lee's has gotten talked about these over the last couple of years. So that's the extent of it, nothing more than that, yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Turney, do you want to?
Yeah, just briefly, because I think it would be unhelpful to hear from Legislative Council staff. But a couple of really important points, and I think the title board has grasped a couple of them. One is that this measure does not cover federal land, which is radically different from the measure in 2016, so would cover a different percentage of the land area in the state by quite a bit. The other is that the fiscal analysis let me address one other thing. I was deeply involved in the legislation that Mr. Dunn says he listened to today, and I'm glad I didn't because it was deeply disturbing the first time around. But one of the things that was hotly debated on the House floor and in committee was how you quantify other benefits to the state. For example, if there was a ballot measure that did away with kindergarten in the whole state of Colorado, you could say that that ballot measure saved the state X millions of dollars. But what you wouldn't say, or what we ended up including in the measure to try to capture, was how do you quantify the damage to the state that would be done for canceling kindergarten for all of Colorado's residents? That it is not apples and oranges to just look at what the revenue impact to the state is without looking at what the damage to the state is. So this gets to the health and welfare statements that are in the fiscal impact. They are required to look at more than just loss of jobs, which I think their numbers are radically overstated. In fact, we were just pulling up data from DOLA that says the number of oil and gas workers in the state is under 12,000 right now. So the loss of 50,000 jobs is a little bit overstated. But including those more difficult to quantify but clearly relevant costs to the state is something that the legislator debated and decided to require, so that there was not just looking a snapshot of what the immediate revenue projections would be, and instead a longer view. So that, and we talked at length about the kindergarten example in committee and on the floor. I also want to say that we submitted a lot of material to the Legislative Council staff on the health and safety impacts of oil and gas development, and they presumably did take that stuff into account. But I think the important information in the fiscal analysis itself is that where If you look at page 3, for example, the measure's impact on the last sentence in the paragraph, or the last two sentences. The measure's impact on local revenue and expenditures will depend on the overall impact on state severance tax revenue and the assessed value of oil and natural gas development in each taxing jurisdiction. So they can't come up with real estimates here. It's a moving target. I also want to point out that the point on severance tax is also radically overstated. The severance tax has gone from $200 million to less than $30 million, and right now is in the red, so that the revenues to the state are not what they once were as a result of efforts by the oil and gas industry to avoid double taxation. So I guess what I would finish with here is all of these point out the staleness of the data that the objector is providing you here and should not be the basis for any change to the fiscal statement here today.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Let's hear from Legislative Council then. Hi, Jason. It's your suggestion. Did you have questions or you want to?
Yes. My question, I guess, would be is, given the information received since preparing the initial fiscal impact statement and abstract, do you have any suggestions or thoughts about any of this? Or do you stand by the original? Just give us your take.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the title board and Mr. Gallander. For the record, I am Natalie Mullis with Legislative Council staff. And yes, I do have some thoughts on it. First of all, we were familiar with the reports from the LEED school and from COGCC in advance. So we did actually take them into consideration. We had taken them into consideration before we received the information from Mr. Brown. The other thought I have is that the statute requires us to write a initial fiscal impact statement and the abstract in, you know, substantially similar form and content to what we provide to the legislature during the legislative process. We have written some fiscal notes during the legislative process on other setback measures in previous years. And I went and looked at those fiscal notes for the record. The ones I looked at were House Bill 12, 1176, House Bill 17, 1256, neither of one of which is exactly like this measure, but both of which do affect setbacks. And in both cases, the way that we wrote the revenue impact and the expenditure impact was very similar to what we put into our initial fiscal impact statement and the abstract for this measure. So, yes, we do still stand by the initial fiscal impact statement and the abstract that we wrote.
Anyone else? Any questions?
I don't know if that's a question. I will say I'm actually a little troubled by the lack of numbers, I guess, in the statement and the abstract. And, you know, I certainly don't envy the job you guys have to do. It's very difficult, and I think you do an excellent job. I worry, though, that without, you know, it's possible to read the abstract as just kind of saying, yeah, things could go down, things could go up. We really aren't sure. And that's always going to be true because there are always some unknowns. My view of the purpose of this is I really think it's intended to give some hard data or ranges or something that will enable the voters to be able to understand what the actual impact is going to be. And I worry looking at the at this abstract and the statement that it really doesn't do that with respect to this measure. So I don't know what we do about that, but I am kind of troubled, particularly where and again, you know, I don't know if the CU statement is good or bad. You know, the lead school provision. I have some trust in the COGCC analysis because I kind of know how they do their work. But having those available and not having, as far as I can see, having them addressed or taken into account, and I know you said that they were considered as part of that, I just don't see that reflected here. And I just worry that, you know, I don't mean this in a critical way, but kind of the blandness of the abstract doesn't provide the voters with the information that we would hope it would, or that I would hope it would, to be able to enable them to evaluate the measure. So I guess that's not really a question, that's a comment on my view of it for everyone.
Any questions for her?
I don't think so, unless you have anything else you want to talk about, like the process or anything like that, that you have to follow.
I would like to respond to the comment.
Sure.
Please do. Yeah.
We don't like to provide indeterminate impacts either. In the process of writing notes for the legislative process, it is our what we consider to be a strong value to provide a number anytime we can provide a number in an accurate and unbiased way. What happens is when we cannot identify an assumption for how a policy change is going to change the behavior of an industry or any part of the economy, if we can't make an assumption for that in an accurate and unbiased way, then we have no starting point for putting numbers to it. And that is what's going on here. The CU Boulder study is put together by some first-rate economists, and I think that their work is world-class. But the study has a different purpose than our fiscal note. It is predicated on an assumption that the entire results of the study are based on, and the assumption is that because developable land is going to be reduced by 90.2%, production will immediately be reduced by 90.2% every year beginning in the first year. That is the assumption that the entire study rests on, and making that assumption is what we find difficult to do in an accurate and unbiased way, and you have to make that assumption in order to put numbers to it. We don't disagree with what, you know, the assumption they made for the purposes that they were doing, but for our purpose of a fiscal note that must look at the entire state, must look at the impact on the oil and gas industry, but also any offsetting impacts for other industries. Perhaps reduced oil and gas development will have other positive impacts on the economy that aren't captured in the CU Boulder study and isn't the purpose of the CU Boulder study to capture. The purpose of the fiscal note is to capture all of that. Not only would we have to make an assumption for how oil and gas production would change and how that would flow through the economy, but we would have to make an assumption for what those offsetting impacts are. We'd have to quantify them, and then we'd have to put that through a model as well. And we just don't have the ability to do that in an unbiased and accurate way. So unfortunately, none of the fiscal impact statements that we have written on these measures have had numbers, and that is why. But it's not something that we like to do. We do not like to put indeterminate estimates into our fiscal impact statements.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I don't have anything else.
I guess I feel like we have to put something there, or at least take the statements about positive health impacts. I mean, I just don't know what to do with it.
Before you go too far down there, I'm going to make one more point. I know I'm wearing out my welcome, but if I heard Ms. Tierney correctly, I'll look at her, that she said that they submitted something to Ledge Council. The statute requires that to be posted online prior to the first title board hearing. And apparently that was not done. We were unaware that any information was submitted other than what we submitted, which was posted online. I'm not sure if that is a jurisdictional issue. That's never come up before. But the public had no ability to see that. The title board didn't have ability to see that. We didn't have ability to see that. So I want to raise that point. If nothing else, preserve it for appeal. But I think it's something that you should consider. And if you need the site, it's 140.105.56, which says that at the same time the director posts the initial statement, they shall post all the data that was provided.
Mr. Dunn, can I ask you a question? On page 5 of your motion, you say the title board should adopt language in the objector's abstract and or return the fiscal impact statement and abstract to legislative council to rewrite. Is there anything in the statute that would enable us to send it back to legislative council to
rewrite? That's a great question. I've thought a lot about that question. I don't have a provision in statute I can point to that says you can send it back. But I don't think there is any reason you couldn't, in essence, do that. You could delay the hearing. You could hold over the hearing till the next title board meeting and perhaps ask legislative council to redo it. I don't think there's anything in there that prohibits that. And I think that would, in some ways, perhaps be easier than rewriting the abstract yourself.
Well, I don't know that it would be, because I think they'd come back with the same conclusion. I mean, we'd essentially either have to tell them what to put in it, which we might as well just do that here. Anyway, Ms. Tierney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of points. One is that the statute does say that the title board shall not conduct a hearing on the impact statement at the title board hearing.
At the initial.
Go ahead, Suzanne.
Yeah, I think that's the initial hearing. You can conduct one at rehearing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what I'm looking at in 140.107, which talks about the rehearing on the initial impact statement, down in B, it says the title board may modify the abstract based on information presented at the rehearing, but I don't see it authorizing us to do anything else with the initial impact statement or the abstract.
I would agree with that, and I apologize. I see where you're looking now. And I think that the legislative council staff has just made clear that they stand behind their statement. And so I would strongly urge you not to send it back to them to just delay this matter further. I do want to address something, Madam Chair, that you said about removing portions of the abstract that address the revenue, the fiscal impact of what the proponents believe is related to the measure, and we would strongly object to that. If there was one thing that came out of this legislative process when the legislature in its infinite wisdom decided to add 140.105.5 to the statute, it was that fiscal impact has to be broader than just looking at the immediate revenue impact to the state. And so the data that the proponents submitted to the legislative council was all about the health and safety impacts and the potential revenue outcomes related to those health and safety impacts. And that presumably is why the legislative staff included it in their estimate. I also want to address one other thing that Mr. Dunn said, and that's in 140.105.5 sub 6, where it says that they have to post. What they have to post is fiscal impact estimates received. It doesn't say they have to post all the data they received. And so we did not provide them a specific draft of an estimate. We provided them a whole bunch of data and a whole bunch of studies that show health and safety impacts, and they then used that to as a part of their analysis to come up with their fiscal statement. So I don't see that they violated the statute in what they did or did not post.
So as I look at the fiscal impact statement itself, I don't see anything about the health and safety until that line is kind of added in under economic impacts, and just as to, you know, to the extent that it improves health outcomes. But I don't see anything in here analyzing whether it would or even addressing that until you get to that sentence. And maybe I'm missing somewhere else in the fiscal impact statement that it refers to that.
Well, it says it in under the economic impacts paragraph.
Right, and that's the sentence I'm referring to that's kind of added in there, but it's not addressed or analyzed elsewhere. You know, there's a section on state revenue, section on state expenditures, section on local government impact, and then with that economic impacts, it has that sentence kind of added in there at the end. You're probably more familiar with this than I am, and I don't know if there's elsewhere that it's addressed that I'm just not seeing.
No, I think that's where they address it, but economic impacts is an overarching category that they are writing a paragraph about.
Sure.
Different than state expenditures, different than state revenue. So it doesn't strike me that that's treated differently than the other items pointed out in the statement.
Right. It just says to the extent that it does, but there's no, as I look at it, no analysis or evaluation of whether it would or whether it wouldn't.
Right. I guess right. That's fair.
Okay.
It's just letting people know that that's another factor.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll start. So I think that the way Mr. Dunn proposes the language is somewhat helpful in that it becomes not necessarily a definitive statement from Ledge Council about what the impact is, but rather cites a study. So to the extent that that provides a voter information, it provides them information about a study done by Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I think the same could be done for essentially what Ms. Tierney's proponents submitted with regard to economic impact, that there are studies that indicate that this will preserve property values and improve health outcomes. And it seems like that would be a fair way to present it, would be to sort of reference these studies rather than substituting a hard number, which I don't think we're qualified to do. I'm just concerned that we're giving the voters really no information. To the extent that we're giving them anything, we're making statements about, you know, may preserve, and to the extent it improves health, it may increase. I don't know. I do have concerns that it's a bit misleading and not very helpful. So I would be inclined to look at something that would talk about what this study says.
Okay. Yeah, I have some concerns. I just don't know what to do, given what the statute says. And it feels odd for us to modify the abstract to include some of this information that's not even addressed in the fiscal impact statement itself. Just for us to put that back in and then send it back. But I'm not sure what else we're authorized to do other than modifying the abstract. And I don't see anything in the statute directly that says we could do anything else. And as we talked about, I'm not sure the legislative council would feel like they could do much else than they've already done. I do like the idea of referencing the study, although I'm also cognizant of you know the timing of the study. Things may have changed, and I don't know if there are contrary studies that look at it differently or come to a different conclusion. So I really feel kind of stuck on this one because I do have concerns about whether we're providing information that's helpful to the voters, but I also am not quite sure what we can do to get to that point.
Can I make one comment on that?
Sure.
Just a quick reference to the statute, 140-107 1B. It says the title board may modify the abstract based on information presented at the rehearing. So to the extent you modify the abstract, it has to be on information that was given to you. We attach those studies to our motion. That's the only information you have in front of you. So to the extent you modify it, it can only be based on that information.
Well, you know what I'm going to say to that. We're here. We're telling you that we've submitted all this information. We've got the information right here. If you would like it to be presented before you, we will present it.
But you're fine with the way their language is regarding the property values and the health outcome.
Yes, but if you're going to start putting in statistics based on a two-year-old study that doesn't even apply to the same land mass because this new measure excludes federal land, I think we would have a big objection to that.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think we could at least say something related to the percentage of the reduction in non-federal land.
If I may, I would suggest that we don't go down a path of inserting any kind of numbers, hard or otherwise, at least not for something this complex that no one can agree to. I mean, I may not, you know, we talk about what legislative council staff gave us possibly being, I would say not misleading is less the word than perhaps not as informative as we'd like, or perhaps not especially helpful. But I think trying with us having, you know, I think not being in a position to judge the quality of this study, the numbers, the studies concerning information presented at the hearing. We have, you know, Mr. Brown has basically said that the industry is volatile, the studies changed. You know, in anything like this, inherently the numbers are estimates. I just don't see how we can really rely on them, especially given what we've heard also at this hearing from Ms. Mullis is that this 92% reduction was an assumption based on if you reduce this much land, it reduces this much production, and that's how much what everything else flows from. And then we have it applying to statewide 2,500-foot setback, which doesn't apply to federal lands, which aren't covered by the measure. I think we go from – I think while the existing abstract we have is perhaps uninformative, it's not necessarily actively misleading. And I think anything we try to do otherwise runs the risk of being actively misleading. I don't like that result. One thing we might think about is whether we can tweak abstract language a little bit. For example, in the first sentence of the economic impacts, it says, thus potentially reduces future oil and gas development. I mean, I think, you know, is likely to. I think there can be some more weight put to those things. I think that's, you know, a reasonable assumption we can probably make based on what we've heard here and just sort of our own common sense. Much beyond slight changes like that, I just think we're stuck. I don't like it, but I kind of think that's where we are. I think we have more of a duty to not actively mislead than we do to try to increase the extent to which this information is informative. Kind of sad, but it's my take on it.
I mean, I just think we do stuff like this all the time when we set titles. I mean, to say we can't, you know, take somebody's language and figure out which things are always going to apply and which things are misleading, I mean, I think we do that every time we meet. So I think we have an obligation to do it, to give, you know, some substance to this statute. And typically what we do when we don't necessarily understand something is just refer back to the initiative. And in this case, what Mr. Dennis presented refers back to a study. Now, maybe we could take out, you know, some of these hard numbers in here, but it seems to me that a lot of this stuff would still apply regardless of what the hard number is, or regardless of whether we're talking about federal land or not. The study estimates that because oil wells typically record the greatest volume of production in the first year, I mean, that's going to apply regardless, right? I mean, that's just something about oil and gas production. And the 2,500-foot setback, I mean, I don't have any reason to think that the study is inaccurate, nor have I heard anything that it won't result in 90.2% reduction on accessible drilling locations off federal land. So it just seems like some of these numbers are true anyway, and we should refer back to the study and indicate that this is happening. I mean, I guess I'm just not willing to say, I mean, that's, it seems to me like it's the proponents who come and, or the opponents who say, I don't understand this measure, so it must not be a single subject, and there's no way to put the language up, and we deal with that all the time. So it seems like we should be able to deal with this. But anyway, Ms. Tierney.
I just wanted to, on the federal land piece, the state is 30% or over 30% federal land, so it really does radically change the outcome of the study. You can't say that it's 90.2% reduction off federal land, because a lot of the drilling now is on federal land. So it's not apples to apples. You can't just carve that out and say it's going to be 90.2% reduction. I mean, I think that's the problem, and I have to agree with Mr. Gellender that you've got to be really careful about putting in real numbers here that are 2 years old that don't reflect not only the current measure, but the reality in the state where oil and gas production has gone down in those 2 years because the price of oil has gone way down. So the number of jobs affected is different and the number of wells affected is different. And it's just a different climate.
Do you agree with the more general statements in the language posed by Mr. Dunn, things like, you know, oil wells typically record the greatest volume of production in the first year? Well, I guess what I'm saying is, would you object to something that suggested that, you know, therefore the measure would likely deplete total production, you know, at a higher rate in the first year and at decreasing rates thereafter or something like that? Or are you sort of objecting to anything?
I do object to that because I think there are other studies that would counter that. And the Legislative Council would say we looked at the available information and we don't think that there's a way to come up with an appropriate estimate there. So
does anybody have a number for, I mean, you know, we should be able to GIS this, you know, 2,500. What land do we have left? I mean, how do we not even have that number?
Well, with all due respect, Madam Chair, I don't think we are in a position in this hearing to have that, to be deciding that stuff. We know that 30% of the state, more than 30% of the state, is carved out. We don't think that the number, what they will do is draw a circle, a 2,500-foot circle radius around every possible drilling site in the state. Well, we can't say that every possible drilling site in the state is going to be drilled.
Well, it's around the occupied structures, right? 2,500 around the...
Yes, but...
And the vulnerable areas.
As related to where you're going to drill, right. So I think it is assuming that you're going to drill everywhere and then taking away and then saying, well, because of this setback, you can't drill anywhere. But that's not right. It's saying 92% reduction without saying you were even going to drill there in the first place. So it is a misleading statistic.
You could say of land available or something. I mean,
but we don't know that that's, but I don't think you can say that 90.2% of
possible exploration or whatever. I mean, you could say there's this much land left for the possibility of drilling.
So there's,
I mean, it's geography. You have to be able to say it.
You're right. But you don't have that data before
you. I know. And that's what I'm saying. I'm frustrated about.
And the data that Mr. Dunn and Mr. Brown are providing you is not accurate because it is based on the whole state not carving out federal land.
Yeah. So what is the proponent's view? If we felt like there was more legislative council could or should do, is there anything we could do about that? Or are we limited just to being able to modify the abstract?
I think the statute is pretty clear that you're limited to just modifying the abstract. And I presume that then the objector's remedy is to see what the Supreme Court wants to do with that.
Just on that point, I think it would help everybody if I think we're at a pivotal moment for the title board.
There's no such
thing. I won't comment about that. I think it's important that you, as a board, make a decision about what your jurisdiction is to do that. Because right now it's unclear to me whether you're, as a matter of preference in this particular case, not wanting to send it back, or but I think that's an important point for you to make and to perhaps vote on about whether you have the jurisdiction to even to consider sending it back. As I said earlier, you know, maybe the option is to hold it over and to ask Ledge Council to revise or to reconsider. Mr. Grove may want to advise you on whether you can do that. I think it's important that we know sort of definitively what you think you can and can't do.
Yeah, let's get our money's worth out of our attorney. All right. I think what we'll do is let's go into an executive session and then take a break for lunch. And then come back and around 12:30. Or, you know, we'll make a motion to go into an executive session. If it doesn't work, then we'll still take a break and go to lunch. Legal advice, do you know the section, Matt? Is it on the agenda for the last one?
So are we in executive session, we're making the motion for it?
We're making the motion for it. Okay. Unless anybody has any other questions before we go in?
No.
Okay. Is it on here, Steve?
No, I missed the reference on there.
Nat may have it.
I don't have my Title 24. Well, I'll just say 402. Okay. I move that we go into an executive session pursuant to 24.6402 to receive legal advice from our attorney regarding the interpretation of this statute.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. So we will go into executive session. We'll leave the recording on, but we'll go off, obviously, the internet. And then we'll come back from there we'll go into a lunch break. So we'll come back around 12:30.